And my head above water is all that I know how to do. But it's kind of beautiful, oh, oh, underneath it all.
We've got an idea. We need to run it past you guys.
Yes. Which idea is this?
Well, I realize also we haven't broken the like podcast up into seasons.
I think I figured we would stop at 69. What do you think?
Yeah.
Do you like that idea?
Okay, so episode 70, season 2.
Start season. No, I think we start over again. Season 2, episode 1.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
Right.
So season 2, episode 1. We start interviewing people from our life, but
yeah.
not like
famous people.
Not like people that are, you know, typically like podcast guests.
Not even people who have anything to do with the theme of this podcast.
I want to interview my dentist.
Yeah.
I want to interview the guy that changed the locks.
Yeah, I want to interview. Yeah, Mark, I'm very curious about him.
I want to find out who takes our trash and I want to interview them.
I want to interview the guy that we talked to about renovating our basement. He's a fucking character.
Yeah. The lady who sold us our mattress.
Yeah, Natalie.
Yes.
Yes, Natalie at Sleep Number. Shout out. She's amazing. I would love to talk to her.
Right?
I would love to talk to her and so many other people at Sleep Number about so many interesting little quirks about their products.
100%. The grocery store people.
Yes.
We want to be one with the people. I don't want to get too big, you know?
No, never.
Season 2, I feel like we're just going to be too big, you know?
Right. Yes. We're getting too big for our britches.
We need to stay humble with the people.
Yeah, exactly. With the hoi polloi.
With all the lower class people.
Oh my God. Oh.
Oh my God. Do you want me to edit this out? You're being rotten. No.
Honestly, I'm just kidding.
And I think that the
idea of having guests, but like not any kind of prominent, like nobody who has, not people who are experts on bipolar disorder. Although you did talk about bringing your doctor on.
Yeah, that would be sick.
Yeah. I mean, there are people who actually, like, can they just weave those in too? So like interview an expert in the field or like some famous person you're friends with. And then the week after that, interview Lee, the guy who's going to remodel our basement.
Love it.
I mean, I think that'd be a great idea.
Yes.
I just like Lee because like, I just like the cut of his jib. He's just like this like rougher on the edges, sort of Boston accent kind of guy who we were talking about putting, you know, Mary's going to put her basement, her studio in the basement, excuse me. He was like, see, so what you probably want to do is like put a big glass window here so that, you know, other people can look in and see when you record. And Mary's like, no, I don't think I need that. And he's like, I don't think you know what you need.
And then we got into a little fight and then I conceded.
Yeah. And I was like, I love this. You guys are just working it out.
Yeah, I do. You know what? I do want a window. I do want to see.
I conceded. You conceded. It'll only cost like, I'd probably be $1,000 extra. Fuck it. So welcome everybody to episode. We're so close.
59.
Don't age our podcast. But yeah, I really do think that should time itself well. And also I can like explain to the locksmith guy what a podcast is and why I want to invite him on it.
I think it would be awesome. Okay, so we need to hear feedback.
I want to be like
this.
I want to be like
let us know on our Instagram or something. Like,
yeah, tell us what you think.
Yeah.
Patreon supporters, let us know what you think.
Yeah.
You know, your opinion actually counts three times as much as anybody else. I want to ask Mark, like, I want to be like, Mark, fucking level with me, okay? How easy would it be to break into this house? Like, you know? I just want to know.
Yeah, but I want to come up with like interesting questions.
Yeah, I want
to
know.
I want to ask my dentist why do you work on teeth?
Why do you want to touch teeth?
I don't trust anyone that wants to touch teeth.
Yeah, because you think that they might just do something like put a bunch of extra teeth in your
mouth. Extra teeth or take all your teeth away.
You can't trust them.
You don't know.
You can't trust them. And I want to ask like somebody who would be made very uncomfortable, our electrician.
Yeah.
I want to be like, what did you honestly think of us when you first met us?
Yeah. I like that.
Or be like, what do you think our podcast is about? If you had to guess.
Yeah.
We can just call it putting you on the spot.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Hot seat.
We'd be like, you ready to come onto the spot? And
yeah.
It's like they come onto the spot and we're like, on the spot, you're on the spot. Do you get it? You're really on the spot.
And then we can have them play gay or straight.
That would be amazing. Oh my God. Please tell us what y'all think of this. Our neighbor.
Oh, that's such a great idea.
I mean, I think we should have every neighbor on this block. So our one neighbor, just really sweet old guy and his wife, and he had like an ex. Should I not talk about him?
Sure, no, talk about him.
he doesn't. There's no fucking way he will ever hear this.
Yeah.
He's a really, really sweet guy. And he brought us like 50,000 onions because he had extras and
brought us a bag of onions.
And I mean, I told him, I was like, man, we've been cooking with the onions. Thank you so much. Yeah. They're fantastic. And he told Mary that he was going to go to Home Depot and asked if we wanted anything.
I was like, no. I was like outside playing with the dogs and he's just kind of over the fence. Hey, Mary, I'm going to Home Depot. You want anything? I was like, oh, my God.
And then he's like, I go every day.
But
you know?
I love you.
It's just a man thing.
He said it's a man thing. I was like,
You're like, no, I need to go tampon shopping. It's just a woman thing.
I just need to go out and specifically buy lipstick.
Okay, do you ever see that like made for TV product? Was this on Shark Tank? It was like you take all your old lipsticks and like melt them in the microwave or something.
I don't remember that. I know there was a lady on the call. I think she did something called the SPAC Daddy or something.
Oh my God, what is
like
that?
It was like you can scrape to the bottom of your lipstick.
I think that stuff. Was it. Yeah. But there's one where you like combine them into like a tube and melt them together.
Yeah, no, that was on Shark Tank.
It's a brilliant idea. People are so brilliant. That and like the atomic bomb.
Yeah.
You just can't account for any of it. Okay, yes, episode 59. Do you want to start with your lies about our Patreon supporters?
Oh, hell yeah.
Go ahead.
Let me tell you about something that happened this week that was... is 100% true. Isabel bought me an edible arrangement.
Oh, sweetheart.
That's so sweet.
I feel like
stars and hearts.
I feel like there have been like several people who bought you edible arrangements.
Wait, have I said this?
Your fantasy.
Have I said this as a lie before?
I just wanted to make you neurotic about it.
Oh my God, I probably have.
It was a different edible arrangement.
No, it sounded familiar when I wrote it, honestly.
It's okay. That just means that Isabel got like fucking like the version two.
Actually, Isabel won a hula hoop competition.
Good. She could do it on the fly, folks. You hear that?
After her hula hoop competition, she bought me an edible arrangement.
Right back where we started. This is actually my five lies are... This is the don't make assumptions about people's behavior edition.
Ooh, okay.
Rebecca B. threw a brick through my kitchen window.
Oh, no.
It was because the baked potatoes in my oven caught fire and Rebecca was worried that I might be in harm's way.
That's so sweet.
You can never make assumptions.
You have to finish the phrase. You have to finish the whole paragraph.
That's exactly right. Don't make assumptions.
You can't just read the first sentence.
Mm-hmm. That's exactly right, honey.
Huge, huge, huge congratulations to Sean Yu, who, you know, he's been on TV lately. We've all seen him, and he just won Top Chef.
Oh, that's amazing.
Isn't that great?
Sean University.
Yeah.
The founder of Sean University.
Do you know every time I read Sean's name, that's what I think of?
Every time I see it, I think about Sean University. Yeah, Sean University. When I was on a walk the other day, Daphna followed me for several blocks before catching up to me and dousing me with a bucket of cold water.
Oh, no.
It was because my shirt was on fire and she couldn't get my attention because I was listening to music on my headphones.
Honey, you have to be careful with flames.
I just realized that two of these so far have involved fire, so we'll see.
That was really nice of Daphna.
Very.
Allison has done something incredible. Allison started an airline called All People.
Okay, I like it.
It's there's space for everybody, and everybody's welcome, and they don't break your wheelchairs.
Oh, that's great!
And they give you space in the bathroom, and there's space for everybody,
and there's leg room, and space between you and other people.
Exactly,
that's great. And I bet that they don't stand up as soon as the plane lands.
Exactly, yeah.
I bet they don't.
And it is mandatory to clap.
When the plane lands?
Yeah.
Hannah took my guitar from my house without asking me.
Oh, no.
It was because Hannah then surprised me with a brand new set of strings and a shiny new pickguard.
Oh, my God.
You know, again, stop making assumptions.
Also, please don't break into our house.
I can't wait to hear from Mark. I want to get the real fucking scoop. You know what I mean? I want to learn about all the vulnerabilities.
I was talking to Mel last week, and she said she joined an ABBA cover band.
Oh, shit. Like, All Saints? Was it All Saints?
What?
There was an ABBA cover band. There was, like, a band that, like...
All Saints do Never, Never, Ever, I Had to Fight.
Shit, no, it was... Help me, y'all. Damn it.
That's All Saints. Saints.
Okay, I have the wrong band. They're All Saints. I'm so sorry.
I think you're thinking of Mamma Mia.
No. No,
that's an ABBA cover band.
No, was it the A-Teens? Do you remember this?
Never, I had to find.
A-Teens were a Swedish pop music group from Stockholm, and they were an ABBA tribute band, originally called the ABBA Teens.
Wow.
You can't come up with lies without doing your research about the A-Teens. And also, I feel like A-Teens, what did I say?
You said All Saints.
That's close.
No, it's not.
Yes, it is.
It's not close.
Yes, it is. It's
okay.
It's a vowel sound and a plural noun.
I'm going to say yes, it's the same, basically.
Big congratulations for Mel for joining the A-Team. A-Teens. What is it?
Okay.
Quinn told everyone not to wish me a happy birthday.
Oh.
It's because they were planning a huge virtual surprise party and wanted to accentuate the delightful surprise.
That's really cute.
Right?
Taryn was abducted by aliens.
Oh, shit.
But don't worry, they all became friends, and now she's the ambassador to aliens everywhere.
Slam dunk. That's really good.
Thank you for the protect.
And really, I was going to say, Taryn really kind of saved us.
Yeah.
You protect, we attack. Emily I ran up to me screaming and shoved me on the ground.
Oh my god!
It's because there was a group of rowdy teens on BMX bikes headed toward me, and they saved me from a certain death.
Oh! Mm-hmm.
Yep. Don't you think we all learned something?
Oh my god! On our Patreon.
If y'all don't subscribe to Patreon. So there's a video version of this podcast available, and I just was very absent-mindedly. I can't even say it. I can't. It's the camera angle.
I'm just saying there is some...
There's some movement, some activity. There's
some legs spread. Spread them, baby. Sorry.
Oh.
Sorry.
Well, the real excitement of this look is down here. I got socks, some slides with sandals. And socks. Yep, like ankle socks with slides. It's just not, none of it's cute.
I love it. I think you look adorable.
Thank you, honey.
And you're wearing my high school colors.
Mariners. Go Mariners.
Oh.
Go
high school.
Go high school. It's not the Mariners, is it?
It's the Mariner Marauders.
Isn't that awful?
Marauders? I didn't know then.
It kind of reminds me of one of my favorite college mascots is, which I'm still... so bummed that there was not a category on my appearance of Jeopardy that was college mascots because
you know so many mascots.
Thank you, honey. It's one of my favorite like useless skills. And
I'm gonna ask you one.
My favorite. Well, I have several favorite college mascots, but one of them is the Idaho Vandals, and it kind of reminds me of the Marauders.
Yes. You know? Yeah.
Vandals. Marauding.
I think in our next segment. I want to quiz you on mascots.
Really?
Yeah.
You'll have to go very obscure to fuck me up.
I'm really excited.
Really? Yeah, I would love to do that.
Next episode.
Yeah, quiz me on college mascots. So we're talking about one of my favorite things in the world today. The thing I think I am most qualified to talk about in the whole world. So I feel competent for once in my life, which is great.
We're talking about legs. What? Isn't that what we're doing?
We are talking about all of the different varieties of SpaghettiOs. The best one far and away. I'll ask you, what's the best variety version of SpaghettiOs?
The best version of SpaghettiOs is no SpaghettiOs.
What?
I hate SpaghettiOs.
Are you serious?
Yeah.
Ugh. Oh my god, why?
No, they just taste weird.
Holy shit, this is I don't know if you can tell, but I'm really jarred.
How do you? You've never seen me eat SpaghettiOs.
I assumed that, like, if you had the option of eating them, you would. Not the one with, like, the sliced Franks? That's the best one.
No.
Oh, my God. Okay, not even, like, a weird organic one chimpanzee on the label?
Especially not those.
Oh, my God. Okay. Damn. What about pizza Lunchables?
I've never had that before.
Guys, I'm so excited for our spec segment. You have no idea what Mary's in for. Stay tuned, please, for this segment. We're talking about language.
Yay!
And as always, do you want to talk about what spurred our decision to talk about this week?
Ooh, yes.
It was an interesting situation, actually. Mm-hmm. You saw somebody on Twitter kind of talking shit about how they, them pronouns are ungrammatical. Mm-hmm. Who is that, fucking Candace Owens or somebody?
100%.
I mean, I feel like if Candace Owens said it, the rate at which I take it seriously drops precipitously, but she has such a huge audience. It's really unfortunate.
100%.
But anyway, so that really kind of grinded your gears. 100%.
And my feeling now when I see something that like pisses me off on Twitter and it's like a figure I don't want to give any audience to, I will just like openly respond as if it were just an open letter and not say why I'm upset or like
subtweeting.
Yes. Yeah. 100%. So,
there's nothing wrong with that.
Yeah.
I mean, but it's an ongoing conversation.
100%. Yeah. And she's definitely not the first person to feel that way. And I think even people in the, you know, in the queer community and like, you know, like, make these sort of stupid claims that like
totally
they can't do it because their, you know, their principle, their commitments, their adherence to grammar won't let them, and it's too weird for them,
right.
And you know, and I think at this point, like, if you refuse to use someone's like correct pronouns, it's just because you're an asshole,
right?
Like, and for me, it's like the same thing as people being like just like being fat phobic and then using the under the guise of like, well, I just don't think it's healthy, you know, like
totally,
like it sucks because I think if you don't know how to like critically think,
yeah,
you're like, oh yeah, that makes sense,
right?
You know, yeah, no, it is grammatically incorrect or something like that.
Sure.
You know? It takes one fucking Google search, you know.
I mean, honestly, I think it's really, I mean, as with most things that enter the culture war this way, like the trans bathroom issue or trans sports, mm-hmm. like usually when it all boils down to it, it's like really much ado about nothing.
Yes.
Like it's not a big deal, but it just gets blown up to this point that it feels like a major point of contention.
Mm-hmm.
And really, I think the pronoun issue is an unfortunate place for the like broader conversation about gender identity to settle. It's right. It's really unfortunate,
yeah,
because I think it has somehow, in like the popular imagination, really warped itself into something that is like a way bigger ask of people than it actually is.
Right. 100%.
And what I'll often hear people do is like, there is somewhere chronicled online, there's like this preposterously long, I say preposterous, it's just a long list of like neo pronouns, mm-hmm. right? So there'll be people who, I don't even know the extent to which this is like a Tumblr phenomenon or if this is real, but it will be people who like, their pronouns will be like unicorn emojis. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I find myself in this position where I will catch myself being like, okay, oh my God, this has gone too far. Mm-hmm. And then remembering like, oh, I have a feeling that culture is like passing me by and that I don't understand the landscape around me as well as I used to.
Mm.
And language is a really convenient place for me to be like, I'm not saying that, you know?
Right.
And people who are like really on the political right who are, or people who just are resistant to the whole idea of like gender, being gender nonconforming or having, you know, a non-binary gender identity, they will argue that the discussion of pronouns is like a matter of free speech because someone is like compelling them to use language that doesn't adhere with their version of reality.
Right.
And to me, I think the place where this is interesting to me as a student of language is I think people who are politically to the right don't like ideas. They don't like the idea that reality is something that is socially constructed. They like to think that there is like
static.
Right, that there's like some externally validatable. That's not a good word. That's I don't even think that's a word. Period. Some like externally stable, discrete, foundational truth, and that language reflects that. And they also are really big on like individual rights to do things, and not succumbing to like things that are in the collective best interest.
Right.
So to me, it's an example of that, mm-hmm. right? It's like a bunch of different things coming together, but I feel like there are enough voices out there saying like, actually grammatical correctness is a bullshit idea. And 100%. You know, like you actually do use singular they, them pronouns. If you're right. talking about somebody whose gender identity you don't know, like, I think there are enough people doing that. I think I'm more interested in this as like a philosophical issue.
Oh, cool.
Like how the role that I think language plays in our culture and in our understanding of reality and in our sort of like political disputes and things like that, just because I think a lot of what's happening arises from like a fundamental difference in worldview.
100%. Or like, you know, a difference in reality.
Maybe. Yeah. What do you mean by that?
Well, I just mean that people are experiencing the world differently.
Georgie fell asleep with her tongue sticking out of her mouth. But her eyes are also doing that kind of creepy thing, yeah, like her third eyelids coming in.
You can't look too long at it. You can't.
No, it's uncanny valley. It's really uncomfortable. Valley. But anyway, no, I'm sorry to interrupt, but tell me what you mean by that, the different reality.
I mean, the different reality is that, I mean, it's Trump world versus everyone else, right. you know? And that, like, there are some things that are factual and... Like things that people can cling to and they say, sure. this is true.
Sure.
And it's not rooted in reality. But then I'm like, well, what is, I mean, if it's subjective, then yeah. what is it? Like,
yeah.
it's that form of reality.
Totally. I know? Mean, right. And I think like, I do think an objective reality exists, but I'm trying to suss this out as a point. So I come from a perspective, in my view, I think, to me, this seems obvious, but I don't think a lot of people see it this way, that you can't, like, as human beings who are, like, we are language-making, meaning-making creatures. Mm-hmm. Like, it's one of the things that, like, separates us from other forms of life on this planet.
Right.
Like, no other creatures on this planet, insofar as we know, you use language quite the same way that we do.
Right.
And no other creatures have like an internal monologue the same way that we do. They right. don't use language the way that we do. Not so far as we know, right? So I believe that we can't know or discuss the world outside of how we talk about it.
Right.
So I think that language plays a constitutive role in our reality. So it like on a daily basis makes up, constitutes, creates the reality that we're living in.
Mm.
And so it doesn't just reflect it. It shapes it.
Wow.
So if you say, you know,
What do you mean by that?
So, I'm thinking about like in the 1980s when the, you know, people in the Reagan administration kind of coined this idea of a welfare queen.
Mm-hmm.
That did not like exist in the public imagination. Yeah. I don't think.
Wow.
It put words to, and in doing that constituted this concept of like, I mean, if I say that to you, if I say a welfare queen, yeah. what comes to mind? Tell me the person who comes to mind if I say that. And by the way, we're like 30 or 40 years removed from somebody saying this. So right. keep that in mind.
Right. Like a black lady that is, that doesn't have a job, that like, just sits around and takes the government's checks. And
interesting, corresponding with the work you're doing right now, I bet she's fat in your imagination 100%, too.
Yeah.
So that did not like what politicians will often do is there'll be like some loose free form concept, some stereotype, some notion in the collective imagination, or maybe it wasn't there before. Tell me that a person in Iowa, you know, who lives in like a town that's like 97% white and has never meaningfully interacted with a black person in their life. Mm-hmm. I don't, how often do they run across a black woman who gets government assistance? Right. I mean, never.
Right.
So they take like little free floating bits of ideas and put them together. And via that linguistic packaging, just that term welfare queen, it is, it's, it is a really powerful thing that I can say those two words to you and you immediately, oh, this image with these like political implications comes mm-hmm. up, that you can conjure it immediately and then like respond to it. Right. Right.
Yeah. Like words as representation, because they are a representative of a thing.
They reflect. Right. So they reflect our reality. Like Welfare Queen reflects the fact that somebody came up with this concept of the Welfare Queen.
Right.
But it's also constitutive in that it constitutes a harmful stereotype. It creates a harmful stereotype.
Right, right. Kind of out of thin air.
Right. That doesn't really exist.
Right.
It really doesn't. Right. So like I'm imagining, you know, like, so yeah, that's my own perspective is that we shape the world as we are talking about it. Mm-hmm. So I mean this as a philosophical matter, like I said. So what I don't mean to say is that language shapes your view of the world. Mm. That's a different idea. Mm. So the people who listen to our podcast who are interested in linguistics, like that's more of a psychological, cognitive kind of matter. Mm. And it's at the root of this idea called linguistic relativity that I think you'll remember this. It's called the Sapir-Whorf hypothesis.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
So, which is actually a big misnomer because Sapir and Whorf never worked together and they didn't publish a hypothesis. They're just two like linguists, psychologists in the 1920s who kind of separately came up with this idea. Oh, I don't know. And it's a sort of like now debunked idea that your perceptions are shaped by and limited by the language you speak. Right. So if you've ever heard that old cliche about like the number of words that Eskimo people have for snow.
Yeah.
Have you ever heard that?
Yes.
That's a Sapir-Whorf idea. Like, oh, they have all of those words. They have different words. They see snow in a more nuanced, complex way and thus have more words for it because their reality is different, right? Right? So like language is shaped by reality, reality shapes language, that sort of thing. So
you don't think that's true or that's been debunked?
It's been debunked because it suggests that the like your understanding is limited by language. Mm-hmm. So I'm thinking about, for example, I think I've talked to you before about this guy named Daniel Everett, who is a linguist and anthropologist who wrote this really fascinating book called Don't Sleep, There Are Snakes. Mm. And I think I've talked about this on the podcast before, but he studied this tribe that lives in the Amazon called the Pirahan.
Oh, right, right, right.
And they had very, very limited contact with like, you know, other groups of people, except for the fact that fucking linguists study them all the time. But what Everett said was, and he got in this like huge fucking academic battle with Noam Chomsky, who I'll talk about in a minute about this. Everett said that this particular group of people, while he was studying them and living with them for years and working with them, discovered that they don't have language for like the distant future because they don't conceptualize it. Mm. Like it's not really relevant to their day-to-day life.
Right.
So also they don't count past a certain, they don't have words like counting past a certain number. And in fact, when Everett like did these studies where he would try to get them to count past a certain high number because they never dealt with quantities that big and it wasn't relevant to them. Mm-hmm. It wasn't just that they couldn't put words to it. It was that they couldn't understand what he was talking about.
Wow.
According to Everett.
Right.
I don't know. And that's like kind of more complicated than like I feel like I'm qualified to really get into, but
so doesn't that kind of his perspective is that Sapir-Whorf is true,
like, yes, exactly,
is correct,
that there's okay. some right that okay. there's some merit to it.
I see.
I think do you remember that podcast we listened to? It was, I think, Radiolab, and they were talking about the guy who studied Homer and found that there were no words for blue.
Yeah, for blue.
And
they used wine red and
right, wine dark. Yeah, yeah. And his thought was like they don't have words for it because they literally couldn't see that it was blue.
Yeah.
And that if they had a term for blue and could connect that word for blue with the color blue, then they would be able to see it.
Mm-hmm.
I don't really know, honestly, the current state of that. I just know that Sapir-Whorf has kind of been debunked. But I think I mean that like linguistic relativism and Sapir-Whorf and all of that shit is really separate from my own belief about language, which is I'm talking about like discourses that circulate that help us to understand and make sense of the world.
Right.
Like those structures enable us to make sense of the world.
Right.
The way that the same way that the idea of the a welfare queen or, totally. You know what I mean?
Yeah, because, I mean, you can hypothesize and come up with ideas, but you'll never really be able to confirm what's going on in another person's brain or another community's, like, you know, connectivity. Like, you'll never be able to totally understand
right.
that.
Right, right.
And... so that is, I just feel like,
yeah,
it's like philosophy, I mean, you know,
exactly.
That's to me what it's like.
And they've done lots of studies because linguists are still pretty interested in this idea. So they will do studies, for example, about whether people who speak languages that have gendered nouns. Mm-hmm. So, you know, like Spanish and French has the same thing, right? Mm-hmm. Like masculine and feminine nouns. Mm-hmm. Like if the fact that those nouns are masculine and feminine influence the way that people who speak those languages, like perceive those objects.
Right.
And maybe, maybe not, but, you know, that's really, like, kind of separate from what I'm talking about.
Right.
I don't think that plays into the, like, the issue of, like, trans people and pronouns,
right.
Like, non-binary people and pronouns. Right. I do think, though, that, like, being able to perceive of somebody as being neither a man nor a woman, like, somebody who wants to, like, exist outside the gender binary, I think that would make it easier to for that language to click, but...
yeah.
It's like neither here nor there. But so really quickly to foreground this conversation. So there are like people who study linguistics say that like language, you can study language at six different levels. And the first three kind of floors are concerned with like structural properties of language. So there's phonology, which is sound, morphology, which is making, you know, creating words, using words.
Yeah.
And syntax, which is structure of words and sentences.
Right.
So those are like kind of the lower tier issues I'm not really concerned about. Those are structural. That's where grammar is, by the way. Like,
yeah, in syntax.
Yeah. It's structural. Like as a writing instructor, we will often call them like lower order concerns, mm-hmm. like local instead of global. Like those are just on sort of a lower tier. Those are concerned with structure.
You're talking about like understanding.
Yeah.
And meaning.
Or using language.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. So people who study language, like, so there are just these two categories, like levels of analysis.
Mm-hmm.
You could study language at the level of sounds. Like those are, you know, people who study speech sounds or speech pathology. That's phonology, like language and sound. And then morphology, words, syntax, sentences. Like you can, and in fact, as I'll talk about in a minute, you can make your whole linguistic career talking about those things.
Yeah.
But the bigger brain version of this, the higher order, the second half, the next three floors deal with meaning.
Mm.
So there's semantics, which is the study of meaning at the level of the word. Pragmatics, which is, I think, is so fascinating. And that's when you study meaning insofar as it is dependent on like social context,
ooh.
Which we could talk about in a second. And that's where I think really like the pronoun issue comes into play.
Mm-hmm.
And then finally discourse, which is like meaning that's dependent on a whole host of cultural factors, social factors, economic factors, who's in power, like all of this kind of stuff. So like the bigger sort of, you know, level.
Cool.
So most people, if they know any linguist, they know of Noam Chomsky.
Mm.
Not only because he's like a, you know, a really famous academic who's been around for like a bazillion years. Mm-hmm. He's at MIT and has been teaching. He's hugely influential, but also he's so politically active and engaged.
Right.
I don't know if you ever watched, there's this documentary that he was involved in called Manufacturing Consent.
Mm-mm.
It's really, really interesting.
Cool.
And for somebody who in that area, you know, he talks about how the way that the media like focuses on and emphasizes and circulates particular stories sets the agenda for what people think about, like this research project I'm doing. Right. But for somebody who cares that much about like social context, he became famous for something that is like totally stripped of context. But anyway, so he really, Chomsky's view of grammar is that, and this is where I think we can see the conversation about pronouns like sitting.
Mm.
Chomsky's view of grammar is that, and I think I've talked about this before on the podcast, how that's possible, I'm not totally sure, but he had this idea called universal grammar, which is basically that human beings are born with the structural, like, structures in their brain. Like, you are hardwired to learn language the same way that you are hardwired to breathe. So like you are born with the structures, like you are born with the ability to learn language. And it's not just language, it's grammar. So
interesting.
He would say, like, it is a human impulse to, like, sort things in some way into, like, sentence structure is, like, an innate ability. And it varies across languages. But he would say that, like, you're born being able to do that. And remember the WOGs that you like so much? That would be an argument for Chomsky, right?
Right.
Because if you tell a very young child who's never heard the word WOG before, doesn't know what it is, if I show him, you know, a picture of a cloud with eyes and I say, this is a WOG, I have one. Here's another one. I have two. And they'll say WOGs.
Yeah.
And Chomsky would say that's because you have the structure in your brain since birth to hear a noun and know if you have more than one, it's plural. Yeah. And to learn. And it's not just that you're born like psychically knowing it. It's that you're born like with the structures in place for learning it. So that once you start hearing other people use language, your brain is like, ah, I see noun. I put that in this slot. I hear a verb. Okay. This is how sentence structures work in our language. Okay. And you're like, they go kind of, they fall into columns like a Tetris or something. Right.
How do you, what do you think? Do you,
I don't know. I don't know. I don't know enough about like language acquisition to have much of an opinion. I just know that like linguists that I like don't think that he's accounting enough for like social factors. We'd call this a structural or a formal view of language. And so Chomsky's whole thing, and they're still linguists who like their whole bread and butter is doing this, is like classifying the formal features of language, like identifying the formal features of language and and organizing them and classifying them
like across the board in all language.
So an example of this would be like English speakers generally use what we call in linguistics SVO, sentence structure. That's subject, verb, object. So in general, when you express thoughts in English, you'll say the subject first, then the verb, then the object. So like the dog chased the ball, right? The dog is the subject acting. The verb is chased. The ball is the object. It's what the object of the verb, right? In Japanese, almost all Japanese sentences are subject, object, verb. If it's like a declarative sentence. So they would say the dog, the ball chased. So this is one of the difficulties in learning to speak another language is that it inverts all of the syntax that your brain gloms onto so readily when you're like under the age of seven is when your brain is like, that's what linguists call the critical age. That's when you're like most primed to learn the rules. So it's really not looking at like cultural context or influence. It's just classifying those formal features of language, right? So, but formalism, the beef that people have with it is it doesn't account for like meaning, for culture, for like what language looks like in use. So, for example, if you have a formalist view of language, and this is not to say that like, this is how you would always look at language, but it's how you primarily look at language. If you look at language like a formalist, if I ask you, so what do you think of your new boss? And you say, oh, yeah, I love him. Like, oh, yeah, I love him. Like, you could even, and these are what we call extra linguistic elements, like the face I'm making that people listening to the podcast can't see. But, you know, beyond the level of syntax, beyond the level of morphology or phonology, there are cultural and contextual factors you'd have to know in order to know that I'm being sarcastic. In order to know that like the literal formal definition of what I just said, oh yeah, I love him. If you take the meaning of that response at face value, then you lose the communicative effect, right?
Do you think some of it relies on written word? Like our, like really taking things apart relies so much on like text?
I mean, I think like linguists like Chomsky, any linguist would like transcribe what people were saying out in the open. So like people who study, I mentioned pragmatics. So like people who study pragmatics would like transcribe conversations going on between people and then analyze the written version of it.
But
so yeah.
I'm saying, but doesn't that sound like it's really limiting? Because that's kind of what you're saying, right? Is like, that's that really limits your understanding or the understanding of that language.
I think that's a good point. And I think what a Chomskyan would say would be like, well, that's just not the focus of our enterprise.
I see.
You know, we're interested in formal features and structures, not social stuff. But like, if you're in a room and you want somebody to close the window and you say, oh, it's a little cold in here, isn't it? Like the literal meaning of what I'm saying is different from the pragmatic function, which is like, I want you to close the window. And I'm using an indirectness strategy to get there. So anyway, so in the mid 60s, Chomsky published a paper talking about linguistic competence. He coined this term linguistic competence. And in his view, that is like the structural knowledge of a language that you have to know in order to be understood by other people, right? Mm-hmm. And it's also the knowledge that allows you to generate like an infinite number of sentences. Mm-hmm. Like if you know subject, verb, object, mm-hmm. and you have the vocabulary you do, mm-hmm. right? The average person has. Think about how many fucking sentences you could make if you sat down and like, were like, you know, the alien ate the ice cream, the penguin saw the fish, you know, like you could do that for hundreds of years and never get all the sentences out of your mind. Right.
Right.
So, that's a structural issue, but that theory doesn't account for the fact that language is constantly evolving. Changing.
Yeah. What about new nouns that are invented?
Exactly. New pronouns.
Yeah.
What about different dialects?
Yeah.
What about African-American vernacular English, which doesn't follow those same structural rules?
Yeah.
Like language, it constantly, it's not fixed in any thesaurus or grammar book or guide, or it's not fixed in anybody's conception of what constitutes correct English or grammar or whatever at that moment. So this other guy named Del Himes in the 70s came up with this idea of communicative competence.
Mm.
And that includes like the social knowledge of like when to say things properly so that they have like social effect.
Right. So that's like meaning.
Right.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yep. It's beyond structure. It's meaning. Right.
Cool.
So, yeah, if you're just looking at formal, you know, features of language, you'll never get there. You'll never reach that sort of understanding, you know.
Yeah.
And you learn language through interacting with people because it changes so much.
Yeah.
So this is the idea behind like language learning apps that really emphasize like interaction and speaking and talking and like collaboratively making meaning, because if you just learn like if you just like memorize all of the, you know, verb endings in Spanish and never use it, that's just not how your brain picks up on language.
Right.
Right. It picks up on it like contextually.
Right.
So I think that that's sort of like more of the attitude toward language that would lead to like a more, you know, open, accepting attitude toward like new pronouns.
Yeah.
But I think it's really, I mean, in a number of ways, really at odds with like a more conservative view of the world.
Right. Is that like prescriptivist versus descriptivist?
100%.
Okay.
Yeah. A prescriptivist would look at like some set of rules somewhere, even though those are constantly changing and not everybody agrees on what those rules are.
Is a prescriptivist just related to grammar, or is it like kind of
just language use?
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. Grammar, punctuation, you know, like correctness.
Okay. Right. And that's sort of like I'm adhering to a set of fixed rules.
Right.
And so should everybody else.
Right. Exactly. Okay. It's an attitude of like, yeah, it's more Chomskyan in nature, mm-hmm. like mm-hmm. classifying formal features of language and sort of like teaching or understanding grammar as structures that you learn and abide by.
Mm-hmm.
It's the red pen approach.
Yeah. To me, that's kind of like, that's like, you know, dogmatic thinking of right way, wrong way. It's very like Christian, honestly. Like,
right.
You know, and you're a descriptivist.
And everybody who, and this is honestly, I think you can trace so many of these attitudes about language and philosophy and like approaches to history and teaching. Like you can honestly tie them down to like political orientation.
Mm.
I think that people who like tradition and are resistant to change mm-hmm. and want things to stay the same, want to conserve the way things are really drawn to the idea of prescriptivism.
Right.
And they do not invite a dynamic view of language or the world. They see things as being fixed.
Marriage is
between a man and a woman. That's the definition.
Trans women are not women.
Right. Yep. There's a biological definition of male and female, and you can call yourself whatever you want, but at the end of the day, you can't play God and change reality. It's that.
Yeah. But it's not reality. It's just a definition that we made up.
I mean, this is where I think it's almost, this is where you run into like almost irreconcilable territory, because it's a different worldview. Like, you know, they find, for example, like people who are politically liberal will look at changing systems to better accommodate individuals,
right?
Conservative people want to change individuals to better accommodate in existing structures.
Whoa.
And they aren't interested in changing them. I mean, this is why they get so freaked out about everything.
I never thought of it that way. And I never thought of looking at their orientation toward language as a parallel for their political or, you know, moral understanding of the world.
Right.
Whoa.
And this is why I think, I mean, if you think about, like, I'm sure that you can find ways that this relates to the work that you're doing about, because I know that you're doing your body positivity workshop right now. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm sure you can think of ways that this sort of mindset relates to body acceptance.
Oh my God. Yeah. I mean, this is like a whole day of class that I'm planning right now, which is like the systems that like are the systems that tell us to look inward and see how we can better accommodate the systems thrive on oppression because they can evade accountability and they don't have to change. Those structures don't have to change. And honestly, I think it has to do with like, because what would we do? I think it has to do with like a lack of flexibility and a lack of imagination.
I mean, do you know what you're reminding me of too? Mm-hmm. Remember when Vosh was talking about the political compass test and there was a question, I don't know if any of y'all have seen that's, I don't know even who it's like responsible for putting this in the world, but it's like, a, you know, 50 or 100 questions and it's supposed to tell you where you lie on like a authoritarian, libertarian, liberal, conservative axis, you know, whatever. Mm-hmm. And there's a question that's like, you know, art that doesn't represent something real is not considered, should not be considered art. And Vosh was taking the test and he pauses on that question. And he's like, oh, the reason they ask this is because conservative people would say that's true. Like art in order to be real has to reflect something real. Abstract art is not art.
What?
Yeah. And I think he's right. And he'd say like people who are liberal love abstract art. And the reason I think for that is, Vosh says, if you have to look at something and think about what it represents, that requires introspection, right? And kind of thinking beyond like traditionalist sort of views of things. And also like accepting that the definition of art expands beyond what you know it to be. Mm-hmm. And there are people who they want what they think is they want tradition, but they want like rigidity. They don't embrace the idea of change.
Right.
So I think language is like much the same way. If you ask, I bet you people who are politically conservative are like so much more fucking anal retentive about grammar than people who are,
yeah,
even if they're not using it correctly. Yeah. I say, do you see what I mean?
Yeah.
I say correctly. But yeah, I think it refers to a broader schism in worldview.
Right.
You know?
Wow, I never considered that before.
I mean, and I think the bigger version of this, like what I'm interested in is like beyond the level of the sentence. Like I am interested in, as you know, the construction of reality via discourses.
Right.
Like this, I mean discourse in the way that Foucault would use it. So discourse is like the definition that I like when I wrote my dissertation, the definition of discourse that I used, I think, was like the strict version is like any language above the level of the sentence.
Mm.
But I mean it to be utterances that construct and reflect broad social or cultural concepts. Uh-huh. So, you know, the example of this that I am most fond of is Foucault's analysis of mental illness, right? Mm-hmm. So Foucault in Madness and Civilization basically says like, so there's this passage from Madness and Civilization where he says, it would be a mistake to try to discover what could have been said of madness at a particular time by interrogating the being of madness itself, its secret content, its silent self-enclosed truth. Mental illness was constituted, this will start to sound familiar, by all that was said and all the statements that named it, divided it up, described it, explained it, traced its developments, indicated its various correlations, mm-hmm. judged it, and possibly gave it speech by articulating in its name discourses that were taken as its own. So think about like discourses of health.
I was just thinking about like how this affects like the DSM-5, like, you know, like the different layers of like the DSM.
Totally.
You know, like how it gives legitimacy to certain conditions.
Right.
And before they're in the DSM, they're not considered legitimate. You can't get insurance. Like,
yeah,
it's important. Like, that's how like essential language is. It's like validating experiences and identities and
oh my God, imagine if you were doing your body positivity workshop and you wanted to figure out like, okay, what did a healthy weight mean in 1970?
Right.
How would you, what Foucault is saying here, you just nailed it. What Foucault is saying here is like, what are you going to do? Go back in time and find the like amorphous concept of healthy weight and plunge into it somehow? You can't. The only vehicle you have for doing that is language.
Yeah. And that's the construct of that time.
And that is exactly. And so the Foucauldian, like, approach to this would say when that idea of a healthy weight came up, it didn't just reflect some kind of conversation people were having about it. It constituted it. It created the idea of a healthy weight by putting a name to it, by dividing it, as he says. What are the words that he uses? Describing it, explaining it, indicating its various correlations, like all of those kinds of things help it to come into being.
Right.
So that in that view, again, discourse is not just like reflecting meaning. It is like as it is created and changed and disseminated and repeated. And because it's so unstable, that it's constantly changing in the forms it's being circulated in.
Wow. I mean, the thing I'm also thinking about is, you know, the quote unquote obesity epidemic. And it created this idea of like fat people as a disease.
100%.
You know? And like that fat is like somehow inextricable. Fat is inextricable from fat people.
Yeah.
And the way that we talk about the obesity epidemic is that like people aren't attached to that. You know, people aren't attached to their fatness.
100%.
And I think that I feel like the attitudes culturally toward fat people has gotten way worse.
100, like,
especially since that happened.
And I bet that in that book that you're reading, what was it, Fearing the Black Body? Mm-hmm. I bet she probably mentions Foucault, I'm sure, right?
I think so.
Because I'm sure that her whole project sounds really influenced by Foucault, because mm-hmm. I think what she's doing is like tracing back discourses of fatness.
Right.
Basically, however they're represented.
Yeah.
And this is all also tied to the impulse that I think so here's another thing that conservative people fucking love is viewing history as a linear progression toward some utopian end goal.
Right.
Right. So I'm thinking about conservative opposition to the 1619 Project, mm-hmm. Nicole Hannah Jones's, you know, project in the New York Times that in which she argues that the real founding of our nation was not 1776, but 1619, when the first ship bearing, you know, enslaved African people arrived on our shores. Conservative people fucking
hate it.
I mean, Trump talked about it a lot.
Right.
That's why he started the 1776 Project.
Right. Because they're prescriptivists and this thing is static and this shapes our understanding. And because if that changes, then what's real? If that changes, then things become unsafe.
It's unstable
mm-hmm.
and unfixed. That's right. And that's why in the view that I ascribe to in Foucault's view is, and maybe I am just like some brainwashed liberal academics. I mean, you do start getting the Foucault brainwashing like day one of grad school. They teach grad students this shit right from the get-go. Right? Like basic Marxist thought. And the way that, and you know, Foucault is not, in my mind, like I don't primarily think of Foucault as like a Marxist thinker, but Marxist thought, like Marxist approaches to, I'm just laughing thinking about a conservative person listening to this. They'd be like, see, as you heard it, you're Marxist. They're all Marxist. But like, and maybe I am.
Yeah.
I mean, honestly, when they talk about like university students being like brainwashed into Marxism, I'm like, kinda. I mean, I started learning about it in my first class.
Well, honestly, isn't that, whoever says the truth has a liberal bias, right? Like,
right. Yep. I think that was Colbert during the when he did the press correspondence dinner. But anyway, so so Marx, like a Marxist approach to studying anything is just looking for the location of power and saying that, like, you can learn everything that you need to know about this dynamic. That's why the critical comes before everything. If you're doing a critical analysis of anything, you're looking for locations of power. So like, how do groups in power exert control over oppressed or marginalized groups?
Cool.
And it really kind of divides the world in sometimes a crude way into like the oppressed and the oppressor, right? So, but Foucault wasn't, in my mind,
conservatives would say oppressed is a state of mind.
Yeah, right? Yeah.
You choose to be oppressed.
Actually, yes. Would say, like, if they were thinking in a Foucauldian way, they might say, you've accepted the discourse that you're oppressed, and then you're going to live according to that. But the Foucault, I don't think, never really, like, explicitly says, like, this is where power happens, ergo, this is bad. He's more just saying, like, there's an inherent, like, shifting instability to all of this stuff. And stuff is constantly changing in relation to other statements. You know what I mean? And there's this old joke that says, like, Foucault doesn't know what Foucault's talking about. But that's part of his, like, praxis. He admits that. Mm-hmm. He would say, I don't even think he really says, like, this is a maxim you can apply universally to any interpretation of history. He just says, let's look at different case studies, which he did. He'd say, let's look at sexuality. Let's look at madness. Like and I know I've talked about this before on the podcast, but he talks about in Madness and Civilization, he says, like, basically the mental institution was invented because we used to have leper colonies and it serves a really isolating some certain group of people that created sort of like a historical model, like a discursive frame for doing
people
that
don't
with
fit.
Other different. Right. So he's not even really saying, like, this is good, bad, or indifferent. Yeah, he's just saying they're related, right? Like, these are related ideas. So he would say that we sort of, like, make our reality and continue recreating and reproducing it, even if we're not aware of it,
right,
you know, via these different sort of frames. So he also said, and I love this, he says, this is also in Madness and Civilization, I think. Yeah, sorry. He says, we must be ready to receive every moment of discourse in its sudden eruption IRR, like its sudden, you know, appearance, in that punctuality in which it appears, and in that temporal dispersion that enables it to be repeated, known, forgotten, transformed, utterly erased, and hidden far from all view in the dust of books. Discourse must not be referred to the distant presence of the origin, but treated as when it occurs. So in other words, meaning like, time is of the essence because it's so unstable. So you have to, like, find it in that moment, like, what, because language is so unstable and constantly shifts, what the obesity epidemic means now is not going to be what it means tomorrow.
Right.
So you need to seize it now.
Yeah.
Figure out what it means in this moment so that you can trace its evolution and its change over time, right? So anyway, I say all of this just to say, like, that I think I see that accepting this view of reality, like, requires you to accept a bunch of other associated patterns of thought that I think are very uncomfortable for some people.
Right, right.
Like, all this shit that I just talked about language, I'm imagining, like, Lee, the guy who's going to remodel our basement. I'm not saying that meant that I'm saying that, like, you know, Lee is some idiot pedestrian who hasn't gone to grad school and therefore doesn't understand Foucault. I'm saying it's not relevant. Do you know what I mean? This is not relevant to Lee's day-to-day life. So, and this reminds me too of how, I don't know if you've heard about, like, this debate swelling, you know, in the culture war about critical race theory.
Yeah.
Again, I said critical.
Yeah.
It's a Marxist influenced approach to looking for, like, the historical role of power as it's been exerted by and against particular racial groups, right? So there's a big debate about whether or not we should use, you know, like Robin DiAngelo and Ibram X. Kendi. And,
right.
Like, remember Trump banned it in federally funded education?
Bonkers.
Right. And that's, you know, what I've heard some people say is, like, that's an example of, like, the hermetically sealed bubble of academia, like, springing a leak and, like, that shit should have never made it out of the university because it's not relevant to most people's lived experiences. I'm not saying that because I think most people are incapable of understanding it. Right. I just don't know how much that's useful if you're not studying its application.
Hmm.
And this is where I think this gets tricky. I really do think it's not about pronouns. It's not even about language. Language is just a
vehicle.
I mean, I say it plays a constitutive role in our reality, but only after we come from like a particular starting point or like way of understanding the world, right? Yeah. And I often think that language doesn't really carve new channels most often. It's following, you know, like erosion that's already happened, right? Like, what is it that you called it? You've talked about it before, like, when you will make like little divots of thought in your mind about how food works, you know?
Grooves.
Yeah. Grooves. Right. And so sometimes I feel really hopeless about this because we're not talking about like a minor difference of opinion. Everything I just told you, all the bullshit about Foucault and all the shit about Chomsky and prescriptivism, like if we just rewind the tape, that's not going to convince anybody who thinks that they, them pronouns are not, you know what I mean?
Right. Because
like, what the fuck are you talking
about? Because it's not about language.
Right.
It's not.
That's what I'm, yes, right. But language is reinforcing and replicating and reproducing every time it's used, is hitting those grooves and re-entrenching them. It is, you know, I'm even thinking now, like, what trans women in sports, you know, like trans athletes has created a new, or it's like water pouring into an existing groove that has already been sort of created and reified by people who don't like trans people and don't want them around.
Right.
You know, and so that already is like a buzzword or like an ideograph, as they say in rhetoric, is like already making it easier to have these conversations because it's like coded language.
Right.
It's making it easier for like hateful people to wink, wink, nudge, nudge each other about transphobia.
Yeah. Like dog whistling.
Right. Yeah. So I don't want to leave this on like a negative note, but
I just don't think there's any hope.
That's a good ending place. No, but like, I think this is where I want to go. I think there are certain elements that these conversations kind of come and go. I think there are certain elements of these kinds of conversations, like about people becoming more politically progressive, that I don't know if they can be forced. I think you have to just kind of like make the changes and ask questions later.
Yeah.
And kind of what I mean by that is like people who were advocates of same-sex marriage, like who would say, you know, oh, the Supreme Court can't just like force this on people. It's going to make things worse, not better. No, it's done the opposite.
Mm-hmm.
You make the decision and like people kind of just fucking get used. They've gotten, they're getting used to it.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
Largely, how much do you hear about same-sex marriage anymore?
Not anymore.
Like,
not really.
So there are changes. And when people say that doesn't work, like changing people's minds forcibly doesn't work, I'm like, that's the only way it's ever happened.
Yeah.
If you had left, you know, Jim Crow laws to a popular vote in the South, they probably would have been reinforced. They probably would have stayed. You know, this is why, you know, it's like when Reconstruction was first happening and there were like, you know, federal troops occupying the South, Black people experienced like an unprecedented level of freedom. They were getting elected to state legislatures and opening businesses and building wealth. And like, that was fucking working. Were people, white people happy about it? I don't know if that's the objective.
Right.
But eventually, if that's the reality long enough,
yeah,
it changes the way people think about it and talk about it. But right. I think sometimes reality has to come before that,
right.
You know?
Right.
So I don't know. I just think it's an interesting, I have sometimes these cynical weeks where I think, I don't know what it's going to take to cause like major shifts in a lot of these areas. But
right.
I think it's good that we are at least hearing different things about it, you know? I don't know.
Well, I mean, I think you can only argue something pragmatically with someone else that wants to think about things critically.
Right.
And the only way that I've been able to find that changes anybody's mind is humanity.
Yeah.
Is like sensitivity.
Right.
And showing like, and that vulnerability.
Right.
And being like, this is my experience. And like, this is who I am. And when you do this thing, it really hurts me. And it makes me feel like I don't belong here or I don't deserve.
Yes.
It, or my experience isn't valid.
Absolutely.
And yeah. When you do this thing, it reinforces that fear and that my feeling of not belonging.
Totally. And I'm thinking, you made me just think about one of my obsessions that I'm going to talk about today is
it looks like a Bible. No, it looks bigger than a Bible. It looks like a dictionary.
It's so readable and so enjoyable. Like, you know, when you're reading a book and you realize how much of it you've read and you get sad because you're like, I don't want this to end. It's like that good.
Are you serious with that book?
The good news is I've got
I'm sorry. It's so, I'm usually not like this with books. Like, but that's a huge book. I'm sorry, baby. It's too big.
You're right. At some point, you have to draw the line. But in this book, he is talking. Robertson is sort of talking about a hallmark of. He really argues like the Enlightenment did not create Enlightenment thought. It's not like all these Enlightenment thinkers got together and they're like, you know what? It's time to, you know, break free of the chains and like, you know, like let's stop the sort of rigidity of thinking and let's discover the world anew. He's like, the Enlightenment was predated by like these shifts that were already happening. Mm. So Robertson is talking about all these Enlightenment thinkers. A real hallmark of Enlightenment thought was tolerance. Mm. Tolerance for example, people from different religions. You can imagine why, because of what happened with, like, let's say Catholicism in its heyday during the Crusades and shit like this and the Inquisition. Like, there was very little tolerance for other religious perspectives, right? And then all these Enlightenment thinkers were like, oh, no. It is ideal to be tolerant. Like, this idea of tolerance was an Enlightenment thought.
Wow.
It influenced the founders of our country, the good things about the founding of our country, at least the ideas, the Constitution, the Bill of Rights, you know, the Declaration of Independence, all that shit, are founded on this idea of tolerating different. That's why there's a separation of church and state in this country, right?
That
the government will not infringe on your ability to practice a religion. That would not have been the case a few hundred years earlier, where like it would have been, you know, there would not have been like a secular state.
Right.
So the idea of tolerance, you know, was born of like Voltaire, all these Enlightenment thinkers. But it started with, this will be familiar to you as a queer person and as somebody who like studies, you know, fat acceptance. The unenlightened version was what they called politique, I guess, is like a French line of thinking that was like, it's a pragmatic issue to accept people of different faiths. These people are here.
Yeah.
They practice different religions. Mm-hmm. We learned from the Inquisition. We're not going to go and like force people by branding their tongues and shit to like accept Jesus as their personal Lord and Savior.
Yeah.
As a practical matter, we have to accept people. Right. Yeah. And then all these other thinkers came along that were like, that is the small brain version. The big brain version is tolerance is good, like as a moral and ethical issue of its own value, you know?
Yeah.
So that's kind of what I'm thinking of with like these shifts in thought about, like, for example, trans and non-binary people. Mm-hmm. I think we can, not to look at history as being linear, but you could look and say, maybe there'll be like some politique version of this where it's like, these people are here and they exist. The practical thing to do will be to accept them and to like change our level of tolerance. Mm-hmm. But, you know, like all these Enlightenment thinkers point out, tolerance, if all you're doing is tolerating somebody, then that's a huge fucking insult. Yeah. Does this resonate with you as a queer person?
You tolerate diarrhea.
Exactly. You tolerate having a cold sore in your mouth. Like, it's not like we need to get past that and get to, oh no, this is a net positive.
Yeah.
Like not just grinning and bearing it. Mm-hmm.
You know what's funny is like, I remember 10, 15 years ago, tolerance was the word people used.
In a positive way.
About gay people. We need to tolerate.
Let's preach to love and tolerance. Right.
Yeah. It was really, that was like the word they used for like gay people. Gay couples.
I know that I'm going to have to edit this out, but I just want to find, hold on. This is, because this is an important.
I remember it really pissed me off because I remember like, thinking, oh yeah, that's good. And then at a point being like, well, like the definition of tolerance is like not good. Like, that's not how you want to, like, treat each other or, like, be in community with each other or, like...
Absolutely. You know? So this is the politician and philosopher Edmund Burke, and Robertson's talking about him in this book, and he says that toleration, the kind of toleration advocated by sympathizers with the French Revolution, was misguided. There was no merit in tolerating opinions that one despised. True tolerance meant treating other people's opinions with respect. Mm. And Burke writes, there are in England abundance of men who tolerate in the true spirit of toleration. They think the dogmas of religion, though in different degrees, are all of moment, and that amongst them there is, as amongst all things of value, a just ground of preference. They favor, therefore, and they tolerate. And then another Enlightenment thinker said, tolerance should really be only a temporary outlook. It must lead to acknowledgement.
Yes.
To tolerate is to insult.
Yes.
Tolerating different beliefs as a political necessity or even out of respect for freedom of conscience no longer seemed enough. Toleration had to grow into a positive acceptance of other religions as being valuable and interesting in their own right.
Right.
So that's where we need to get. Like, I'm thinking about your friend Lauren. Is it Zuniga?
Yeah.
And I just think she's the bee's knees, and she's a poet, right? And
yeah.
Lives in Oklahoma. And I saw on her story, this is the kind of reframing I'm thinking about that's like so fucking helpful, I think, that reminds me of this Enlightenment thought, is she wrote on her story, like, the idea that you would just tolerate trans kids in your kid's sports.
Yeah.
She's like, you should be so fucking lucky as to have a trans kid to teach, to help, to instill, like, you know, like to have like the beauty of like a trans person,
yes,
to like model, you
100%.
Know, it's to model that kind of existence. I don't want to say like strength or resilience, because I'm right now really reflecting on this whole idea. Like, a lot of my trans friends have been posting things about like, stop calling trans people brave.
Yeah.
You know, like, because if you fucking it's like the social model, like, if you change the world, we wouldn't have to be fucking brave and resilient.
Exactly.
But like, you should be so lucky as to have a trans kid in your 100%. Kid's sports.
Well, yeah, and I think that's why, like, I think people that are not progressive really feel like diversity and inclusion is to the benefit of the, you know, whoever adds diversity, right?
Right.
When it's like, right. No, dude.
You mean like the underrepresented group?
Exactly.
100%.
No, dude, you straight white guy, like, your life is going to be enriched because like, everybody, like, inclusion lets everybody win.
This was like the argument in the 1950s, like pre Brown versus Board of Education, about integrating public schools.
Right.
It's not something you're doing as like a charity case for black students.
Right.
Like, you are really depriving white students of the whole of the possible educational experience.
Right.
But yeah, I think so. This is a better note to end
totally.
On.
Yeah.
Not necessarily end on. That was abrupt.
No, and I think another part of, like, fat activism and, you know, fat liberation that I've been reading about is really the connection to disability justice that has, like, that now it's been such a great model, I think, for fat activism, because it's like, wait a minute, like, people fighting for disability justice have been doing this for so long.
Right,
and,
right.
Like, we're talking about access, you know? Like,
sure.
And just, like, basic, like, let's just get access, you know? And I was thinking about when I was in high school or in elementary school, I didn't know anybody who was disabled. I didn't know anybody that had any disability.
Right.
And I realized, I'm like, oh, that's because they fucking locked them away in a different classroom.
Yeah.
And nobody got to, like, I feel like I was robbed of like friendship,
yeah,
you know, or like connection.
And Foucault would say that that is all you could follow a, you could do like an archaeology, as he would say, you could go back and do an archaeological dig and find, going back to the days of leper colonies, this idea that you take people who are different or who are disabled and you remove them from view.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it continues that cycle, that we are all better for not having them around.
And us
it
versus is them.
Absolutely cancerous thinking.
Yeah.
You know, when has that ever benefited anyone?
Right, 100%.
I know, I don't mean to conflate those two, but like, he just said, like, that's, I'm not saying they're parallel, but like, that the impulse, that's an impulse, unfortunately, of like structures of power.
Yeah. So let everybody in. Inclusion always better than exclusion.
Let everybody in.
Let the bear into your house. If the bear is by your house, open the door.
Don't make him dig through your trash cans.
No.
It's wrong.
You saw a bear in a tree.
I did. I saw two bears in a tree. It was fucking electric. I didn't know that they climbed trees like that. He was way, way, way up there.
They were going to help him get down.
I'm sure they are. Are you ready for a segment?
Oh, my God. Oh, my God. It's time.
It's time for the segment. How's your appetite?
I'm hungry, baby.
Well, this is probably going to ruin it.
Oh, no.
Do we have a name for this segment?
What's in my mouth?
No, because I want you to, like, fully understand what you're appreciating.
Okay.
Or do you want to be, like, blindfolded for this?
No,
I think you should know.
No, I want to know. Because I want the packaging. I want the feel.
And I haven't tried any of these things either.
I'm so scared about what you got. What did you get?
So this is just we're trying stuff.
Yeah.
I.
Mary and Wyatt try weird food.
Try weird food.
Yeah.
Mary had this idea. I went to the grocery store by myself. I found 5 items. 3 of them are ambient. 2 of them. One of them is refrigerated. The other one is frozen.
Okay.
And we're just going to try these 5 things together.
You know, I got this because I've been still obsessed with Aubrey Gordon's podcast Maintenance Phase. Uh-huh. And in it, if they're covering like some sort of like shitty diet food or weird miracle green juice, moon juice or whatever, they buy it and try it. And then they like talk about how it tastes and feels. And
that podcast is so great.
It's so good. Michael Hobbs, like they were trying celery juice. The last episode was on celery juice. And Michael Hobbs said, this tastes like a hate crime.
You're like, what is it? I remember at one point he's like, tastes like fucking celery. And they're like, okay, don't look.
Oh my God. So are you going to reveal one by one?
Yes.
I'm obsessed.
Okay, would you like to start with cold items? Or would you like to start with...
Yeah, cold.
You want to start with cold?
Yeah.
Okay. I have my little lunchbox here. How cold? The coldest or second coldest?
Second coldest.
Okay. We are going to be trying something that, because of some glitch in the Matrix... They're allowed to sell as yogurt, I think.
Oh, no. Oh, no. What is it? Oh,
this is Reese's Colliders. chopped. This is peanut butter flavored dessert.
Oh.
You know what is dessert? It doesn't get any more specific than that. Peanut butter flavored dessert with milk chocolate pieces and other natural flavors.
Oh.
Are you ready to try this? The first ingredient is just peanut butter flavored dessert. It's made with partially defatted peanut flour, modified cornstarch.
Oh,
don't look at the ingredients. We're evolving past looking at the ingredients.
No, yeah, right? we don't look at ingredients anymore.
Are you ready to try?
Yes.
So,
oh my God.
For those of you listening, it's like a boat of peanut. It looks like straight up peanut butter.
Yes.
And then another boat. So I'm opening boat number 1.
It looks like peanut butter. Oh my God, that looks like diarrhea. I'm sorry. That looks.
And then there's another tub of chocolate pieces.
You know what? I'm the chocolate looks good.
Okay. Are you ready?
Okay. Do I have a spoon?
Right here.
Oh, wow.
I came prepared.
Okay.
All right. So just go ahead and mix that up. Reese's Colliders, ladies and gentlemen. I'll take a bite after you. No free ads.
God, okay.
Sponsor the pod, Hershey's, you fucking cowards.
Okay.
Is it good?
Mm-mm.
What is it like? Okay, describe it. Describe the mouthfeel.
The chocolate is good.
Uh-huh. What is the dessert like?
The dessert tastes like, like watery, like super watery, sugary yogurt.
Okay, let me try it. You know what's so funny? I'm a junk food fanatic, but I told you, I was shocked at the grocery store. I have standards higher than I thought. This is not, say what you will about me, I would not buy this.
Yeah.
Under normal circumstances. Okay. Oh, that's really bad.
It's really not good.
I thought it was going to be more like peanut butter.
Yeah, it tastes nothing like peanut butter.
Your description was really good. There's not even like a suggestion of peanut butter.
No.
Chocolate's great.
Yeah.
This is really bad. I feel bad also because I'm just realizing how much food this is going to mean we waste. I'll feed it to the kids down the street.
Okay. Now, do you want a frozen item or yes. do you want an ambient item?
No, I want frozen.
The frozen item is...
Oh, what is that?
It is a sour apple flavored slush puppy.
Oh, no.
That importantly contains no fruit juice.
And the
back of it says, do not microwave, consume in one sitting.
What? Why? Is it medicine?
I don't know. It is manufactured by Big Easy Blends. And you're not going to worry about the ingredients. We're not thinking about it. All right.
Oh.
Ready?
Oh my god. I feel like I'm going to vomit. Okay.
I don't.
Oh my god. It's in a tube. How do you even get it out?
I don't know. Hold on. You might just have to kind of like lick the top of it.
Was it supposed to be? It's frozen. It's supposed to be frozen.
Yeah, it's right? frozen. It feels like a slushy, right? It's like in a pouch, listeners. I think you might just have to kind of lick the top of it. That's what she said. Were you able to eat it?
Oh, man. It tastes like worse Mountain Dew.
It does?
Worse frozen Mountain Dew.
How would you rate it compared to the Collider?
Man, both pretty bad.
I feel like a really nasty sugar high for the Collider.
By a small, small margin, I would probably eat this.
Really?
God.
Crazy. Did you wish you hadn't come up with this?
Electric green.
Oh my god, it's like a melted Jolly Rancher.
Yeah.
Jesus
melted
Christ.
And then refrozen.
Okay, I don't want to consume in one
slush
sitting.
Puppy?
Why would you microwave this on God's green fucking earth? I guess to make it a little bit softer.
Oh, that's why.
Okay. So far.
But it does have a really, to be fair, it has a really cute dog on the front.
It does. He's got a hat. A beanie and his tongue's hanging out.
He's like a snow dog.
Okay.
Very cute dog, very bad beverage.
How are you feeling in terms of sweet or savory craving right now?
I need savory. I need something to break it up. Yeah.
Well, then what you really need are Doritos 3D Crunch. These are, I don't know. They look like they might be like puffed, right?
Yeah, yes.
Like a, what do you call them? Like a Funyun?
Mm-hmm.
So it's Doritos Crunch chili cheese nacho flavored.
I love that it's 3D.
Allegedly taking crunch to another level. All right. Go ahead and dig in.
Okay.
Yeah, they're little puffs.
They kind of look like they're going to be like bugles. They kind of look like
bugles. That's what it's like. Bugle.
I love bugles.
You go ahead.
Okay.
Oh.
A real zing.
Okay. I'm not going to lie.
I love them. No, I don't like that. It's really spicy. Mm-hmm. Why is it so spicy?
These are dope.
Why is it so spicy? My mouth is on fire.
It really does taste like Frito pie. Like spicy Frito pie.
To me, it tastes more of like the Cool Ranch Dorito, like a Cool Ranch Dorito with spiciness.
They had a spicy ranch version of this, but I opted for
that. That's spicy. I can't imagine what the spicy one is. Is it spicy to you? You love it.
I'm going to eat the fuck out of this.
You know what? I think that would be really good to dip into sour cream.
Right? This is kind of a way homer. Doesn't have kind of a pleasant... No, you don't like it.
You know what? I'm going to say this. I love the texture. It's got the texture of a bugle.
The texture.
I could eat a bag of bugles.
Down. I'm down. Okay. Now the last two are sweet.
Okay.
The first is so fucking weird.
What is that?
Limited edition Tic Tacs that are made with Coca-Cola.
Oh, no. What?
Yeah. This was also the most expensive item of any of them. This cost like $4. Yeah. I spent $20 on this fucking trip, by the way, so y'all better enjoy this. I don't know why I'm talking to them. It's not their fault. You better eat every bite of this shit. Okay, no, sorry.
I don't want to eat so many Tic Tacs.
Okay, here. You want to just try two?
I need to cleanse my palate.
Yeah, me too, actually.
Do you have the bucket? Just kidding.
Holy shit. I'll try. And I'm a Coca-Cola fiend.
Yeah. So is it minty or Coca-Cola or both? Okay.
Oh, it's so strange.
Is it really?
I'm giving Mary two of them.
Okay.
My palate, I can't locate the
taste. Ew!
What is that? What is it?
It's like, it's hitting my sour part.
Yeah. You know what? Trying all of these, I'm like, oh, they are hijacking the human brain. Like, all of these different flavors. This is...
But I also can't stop.
I kind of like it.
To me, it tastes like... like tropical gum.
Yeah.
You know?
I don't know what this has to do with Coca-Cola, and there's just no description of it whatsoever. Oh, are they,
because it maybe, does it have a little of those like pop rocks mm-hmm. feeling?
A little
like,
bit of that, yeah.
Like carbonation.
Also, this looks like a garbage can, kind of, and I like that.
I'm chewing it. I'm gonna let this go.
Need the bucket.
I chewed it. I'm gonna swallow it.
Okay.
That's what I do with Tic Tacs.
This is really not...
I don't like that.
Mm-mm. I don't either. Okay.
Well, you know what it is? It's because I'm expecting Coca-Cola. If you would have told me it's like a fruit Tic Tac...
You would have liked it.
Yeah, but it's the expectation. So you think you're gonna have Sprite and then it's water.
100%.
Yes!
Brain. Or when you think it's gonna be Coke and it's iced tea. Yeah. Unsweetened iced tea.
Oh, God.
So far, I have to say, bottom of the pile for me is that Reese's Collider was repulsive.
That Reese's thing is so bad. My stomach is still turning.
It should. I don't want to look at it anymore.
I think I need to... I don't know what I need to... I need soup. I need, like... I just need plain broth after this.
I actually want a salad.
Yeah.
And this, too, is like... This is a crime against
humanity. Yeah, I want to make a salad after this. And not for any moral reasons, just because, like...
I want one, too. I want... Can I have some?
Yeah.
I need it. Okay. Yeah. The last item... This one, I feel like, was kind of cheating, because I know this is going to be good. This is the last item of savory. It's Goldfish Grahams s'mores flavor.
Ooh! Okay, but not the cheese. It's not cheese.
I think what it has...
They're just in the shape of a goldfish.
Okay, the conclusion I'm coming to, there also, I love it, it's 8 grams of whole grain per serving. Shut up. What I am surmising based on the packaging is that there's a graham cracker goldfish, a marshmallow goldfish, and a chocolate goldfish.
Oh, that sounds fun.
Let's see if I'm right. Okay, open your hand.
Okay.
Pepperidge Farms sponsored pod.
Oh, no. Whoa. No, they're all different. Okay, they're not attached.
So
they're all single.
They are 3 discrete items. I gave you a lot, but it's because I wanted you to have a graham cracker.
Okay, I'm going to have the graham cracker one. Oh, okay. That's a good graham cracker. That's a good chocolate. It's a good chocolate thing.
You know,
it's a fun marshmallow.
I actually hate this.
I love this.
You do? You like this one?
Oh my God, I can't wait to eat this.
I don't know what it is. There's something about this is offensive to me.
Well, because you are a s'mores fanatic.
I am a...
So you're probably expecting more of a s'mores vibe.
This is weird.
What?
On the back of this package, there's a goldfish named Extreme. X-T-R-E-M-E. And there's a quote around the image of him. He's sort of, I don't know, smiling pleasantly, I guess. Have a great day, and don't get yourself all twisted in a knot. What is that?
Oh, because there's a goldfish pretzel?
Oh, but they're not, it's
not in a knot. So you're not going to be in a knot. You're going to be a fish.
Speaking of language. Also, I really like though that the goldfish on the front of the package has like a little camping, like a scout.
Yeah, he's a little hat. He looks like a Boy Scout.
Do you want to put those back in here?
No.
You like them.
Wait, I don't like the chocolate ones. I like the marshmallows and the graham cracker.
I really, honest to God, I'm going to ask our neighbors if they would like to give this to their children.
No, don't give those away. I want these ones.
Okay.
I think they're cute.
And I don't feel right about giving them this. I don't think anybody should have that.
I don't think anyone should have that.
This should be, like, quarantined and taken out of
circulation. I'm trying to think. I'm like,
nobody deserves this.
I feel like it's just toxic sludge that they put sugar in and, like, they just needed to get rid of it so they didn't have to follow EPA guidelines.
It was like they needed to, like, clean out, like, a 20-year-old peanut butter vat. And they're like, I don't know, care.
Peanut butter dessert?
Did I tell you about the vending machine at my high school that had, like, a cheese stick and a sausage stick, like, a little packet in one? And I bought it one day and ate it because it's the kind of shit that I ate in high school.
I did the same thing.
And actually,
I know exactly what you're talking about.
And it was labeled, the cheese stick was labeled cheese flavored food product. That's like this peanut butter flavored dessert.
Oh, I'm still reeling.
Okay, I'm just going to say it. What? Of all of these 5 items, these chili cheese 3D crunch nacho Doritos knocked it out of the park for me.
I will say that I just feel terrible after all of them.
This was not...
My mouth feels awful.
This was not... My mouth feels like it's coated.
Yeah, my tongue feels thick with... God knows what.
Maybe we shouldn't have done this while you're doing, like, an intuitive eating workshop.
It's helpful for counterintuitive eating. Yeah, I got to think about what I was eating. And
also just this display in front of us. Those of you who are watching on Patreon can see it's a sad, it's I will say I this went through a roller coaster of emotions buying all this shit at the grocery store. I really did not want anybody to judge me. Like a 7-year old.
Did you have any shame?
Yes, actually, I did. I had a lot of shame. Yeah. And so I'm interested in that. But like after eating it, I'm like, oh, no, that was that's you shouldn't be proud of that haul. What's your first obsession?
I'm obsessed with this. So, I mean, I'll shut up about the workshop, but probably not for the next couple episodes because I'm deep in it.
This is an audience that cares very deeply about your workshop and wants to hear about it.
I'm reading this book by Laura Thomas called Just Eat It, and it's got this beautiful pink donut on the cover. And Caroline Dooner also has a book called The Fuck It Diet. And they're actually really similar. But I started reading Laura Thomas's first, and I just love how accessible the language is and how she's breaking things down. I'm just so loving the book. And there's another book I'm reading called 7.5 Myths About the Brain or Truths About the Brain or something. And I'm loving reading that too.
I just love all the prep you've done that you're doing for your workshop. I've just learned so many cool things via your workshop already.
I'm having so much fun.
I'm so glad. As I mentioned in our previous discussion, my first obsession is still this book about the Enlightenment I'm reading. And I just came across this really interesting chapter about this, what they call in theology, the problem of evil, which is like this perennial issue in trying to like come to terms with the existence of a benevolent God, an explanation of why a perfectly good almighty God permits evil to exist in the world. Mm-hmm, right. Like that's a theological thorn.
Yeah. It's a conundrum.
It is. And I've discovered this argument I find very interesting. So this is a prominent Enlightenment thinker that I was not familiar with until I started reading this book, but he's a German philosopher named Gottfried Leibniz. And he came up with this really interesting explanation for what they called this the theodicy, the explanation for how we justify the existence of evil created by, but if God created everything, why did he also create evil if God is benevolent, right? And so I just thought this was so interesting. So his argument is that God could contemplate and create any world out of an infinite possible number of worlds. And he created one because he is supremely powerful. The world that he created has to be the best possible world, right? Mm. So we might think that the best possible world would be one in which, you know, evil didn't exist and Adam and Eve were never tempted by Satan and all this shit. Mm-hmm. But then it's like, oh no, but you are not as smart as God. You just aren't. This is a theodicy, yeah. Right? God is smarter than you and more capable than you and more all-knowing than you. So it is, it had to be that the fall of man had to be. The arrival of sin in the Garden of Eden and after had to happen. It was a fortunate event because it necessitated this supreme display of goodness from God. Mm. So it's this idea. I just love this argument. I'm really interested in any like theological arguments. Yeah. So there's this other theologian that I'm also really fascinated by named Saint Anselm, who made what he called an ontological argument for God, which was that God exists because you can't think of anything greater than God. Therefore, he has to exist.
Right.
Also, like a teleological argument for God would be one where you say, you know, God existed to create the world because that's what gods create worlds, you know? So anyway, I'm just really interested in these kind of like theological arguments. This is so cool. Yeah. You like those?
Yes. So what's the belief that God created the world and then peaced out?
I forget the term for it. Right. It's, I forget the word. I forget the word for it, but yeah.
Deism?
Deism?
Deism.
Yeah, right. Yeah. I think you're right. Like, deism, yeah. Right. That God
created the world, but doesn't really have an ongoing stake in its continuing, like, doesn't really meddle in the affairs of us, right? His only job was to create the world.
God was here, and then she left.
It's really, really interesting.
And we hate to see her go, but we love to watch her walk away. Oh
my God. Fair enough. God is thick with two C's. What's your second obsession? Let's get away from this before we roast in hell.
My next obsession is this awful podcast.
I just farted.
That I can't stop listening to. At first, okay, so part of my workshop, I'm doing some one-on-one coaching, and I think I'm having some self-doubt because I'm like, I've never coached anyone before. Right. I'm a mess. Like, I tried to cure my bipolar disorder with tequila once, you know? Like,
physician, heal thyself.
Yeah. But I also think I'm like, you know, if I really think about how far I've come in my journey with like loving myself, I'm like, oh, I do have a lot of tools. I have all of these resources. Maybe this would be helpful.
Sure.
But I was like, you know, is there something I'm supposed to know about like coaching? And, you know, and I'm like, and then I was like having this like existential crisis. Like, am I a life coach? Like, what does a life coach do? And so I started Googling life coaching, and then I'm like, do I need a certification to do this?
Right.
And then the only thing I could find is like most certifications, they like, part of it is like how to help your clients lose weight. And I'm like, not doing that. So I looked up like, oh, is there like a life coaching for life coaches? Mm-hmm. And I looked it up on like Apple Podcasts. I'm like, maybe I could just like listen to a podcast of like, how can I really help people? And this podcast came up called, I don't know if I should give any airtime to
it.
It's called the Life Coaching School. And it's this woman, what's her name? I can't remember her name.
Castillo?
Yeah, Castillo.
You're nervous about saying this.
Yes. Y'all, it's so bad. I started listening and I was like, I can try to take nuggets from this. Like, she's obviously like really problematic and, you know, like is part of diet culture and has all these like the principles of her beliefs are like, you know, it's important to be take care of yourself and mm-hmm. wellness culture and obviously like just coding for thin. But when I started listening to it, I just burst out laughing at some of the preposterous things she was saying. Mm-hmm. And at one point she was saying, people will judge you if you're rich.
Yeah.
And, you know, and you don't want to, if you do this thing, you don't want to do that because then you'll be a really bad representative of wealth.
Being rich. Right. Yeah. You don't want to become one of those people who's a bad
representative of wealth and power.
I hope that like Brooke Castillo stans aren't some like huge force in the internet. But I will say, you heard what I just said about Foucault. I have listened to a lot of word salad in my life, a lot, from a lot of people who don't know what they're talking about. And she is the most salad-y of word salad. She is not saying anything.
It's amazing. It's like when Michael Scott just goes on and he just starts and he doesn't know how to stop and he's not saying anything.
It's like if you reached into a bag of like the like magnetic poetry, but it's like, it's like, you know, like shitty new age vocabulary edition and just like threw it against the refrigerator.
I think she's like the Republican Brené Brown.
Yeah, that's a good, can I do an impression?
Yeah.
She's like, and if you think then that the image of you working alongside other people and just that thought of your own drive toward the perfection that other people want to see in you is closed, then the ones that really do have your best affirmations in mind are going to go away. Right? It's like that.
100%.
Like, that's not a coherent thought. No. But like, if you're not really paying attention, you're like, oh, okay, right. Yeah.
Most of 50% of my life is good and 50% of my life is bad.
That was another thing. She did this weird, like, life is intended to be this gauntlet of misery and that's what it is, and if you expect anything different you're a snowflake. It's fucking weird.
Anyway, I cannot
I ate another handful of Doritos.
I don't don't know. And she also, like, what was the one part where she's like, you know, I've decided to speak into existence my desire for friendship. So
I've started doing something. And what? She said it in the creepiest possible way. Yeah. Oh, no, I'm quoting her. Yeah, she was like, I've done it. I've started asking women for their phone numbers. I'm like, what?
She's so clearly gay.
She's like, I've started doing it. I think the best way to maintain a meaningful friendship is to make love to them one by one.
And she calls things false pleasures. Like when you enjoy like eating food, she's like, that's a false pleasure.
If it feels good, it's pleasure, baby. Yep. Is she one of those people who thinks like the only real pleasure in the world is like doing body weight squats?
Yeah, and purity and being chased.
Oh, y'all should if you want to laugh, like it's go into it with a good sense of the absurd. You'll have a really good time. It's preposterous.
Just every other word, I go, what did you just say?
You know what? Fair enough. I think if she listened to this episode of this podcast, she'd be like, thing. What the fuck?
Yeah,
we're not speaking. We're in different bubbles.
Yeah, 100%.
My second obsession is the Nerf gun that I bought for the dogs.
Look what I have. Oh my god! I wrote down Nerf gun.
That is so fucking cute.
Oh my god.
Yeah, it's just exactly what it sounds like. It is a plastic gun that just shoots tennis balls across the yard, and the dogs are obsessed with it, and they get really excited just seeing it.
It's so cute, and it's also really satisfying to do.
Like, it is. It's like kind of a pressure release.
Yeah.
It's really fun. And having a fenced backyard is like everything I thought it was going to be.
It's a dream.
I mean, it's
because we used to have to put the girls on a cable, and I just felt like an asshole. I just felt it felt cruel,
right?
Because we couldn't like fully play with them because it would like strangle them, right, if we played too.
And then sometimes they would like see a rabbit or a squirrel or something, yeah, and run toward it, and blah 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 blah. But yeah, that's my second obsession. I'm having a blast, and I need to stop, actually. And I also bought a Chuck It. It's like that plastic thing that throws a tennis ball really far. And I don't know if it throws like normal shaped tennis balls, but I think part of the scam is that like only really fits.
You have to get a Chuck It ball.
Right. But so I ordered this pack of balls. It was actually more expensive than the actual device. And one of them whistles through the air. Like, as when you throw it through the air, it whistles.
That's so cool.
Another one of them bounced really high. But I took them to the dog park today, and Georgie took each one of them and just took it and dropped it in the river. And then it caught the current and just floated away. And I've learned my lesson. Now I'm never buying anything for them ever again. What's your third obsession?
My last obsession was going to be the Nerf gun, but the other thing I also wrote down was bagels and cream cheese.
Oh, yeah. I'm really into it.
Yeah.
Thanks to Starbucks. Yeah. Started this for us.
We're having a moment.
And it doesn't feel too big.
No, it feels just right.
Plain bagels with cream cheese. It's like the golden slice of cheese pizza.
Yeah.
It's just when you find somebody who just nails the basics.
Yep. It's good.
And my third obsession is keeping our house at a livable temperature, which has been an adventure. We got a mini split installed, which is something I didn't even know what the fuck that was until a couple of years ago. It's just like somewhere between a window unit and central AC. Right?
Yeah, exactly.
And they had to like drill a big hole in our house and run pipes down the side of it. But now our bedroom, whenever it is our bedroom in the future, is like a fucking meat locker.
It's an ice tunnel.
I'm obsessed with it.
It's so great. And especially after the weekend we had, it was like 80, it was at 90, it was 90 degrees here.
Yeah.
And we had to leave the house. It was so bad.
It was spicy in here.
Yeah.
It got a little spicy. All right. Are you ready to read poems?
Yeah. Will you read me your poem?
I would love to.
It better be good.
Oh my God. Stop. So this is a poem by Richard Blanco. Mm. And this was published in the New York Times Magazine this past week. Mm-hmm. And it's called And So We All Fall Down.
Ooh.
And it was named after and for an Anselm Kiefer art installation.
Mm, cool.
And so the hunks of pavement heaved and set before us are every road we've tired, and those we wish we had, and those we will, and those we never will, or those that'll dead end when our empire ends. And so let our debris to be reassembled as tenderly as these curated bits of rubble, letting us see how chaos yields order and order chaos. And so let our nation's faces be these boulders, like tiny bruised moons out of orbit.
Whoa.
And yet enduring, still spinning across the shiny gallery floor, despite the brutal love of the universe and brutal love for our country. And so let us believe we won't simply end like the speck of a star that will explode as quietly as a poem whispered above our rooftops into a black hole and into the night. And so let us believe there is still eternity even in our ruin, like this art made out of those remains, made more alive by destruction. And so all the dead stalks of these sunflowers, embalmed with paint and fixed by our imagination, dangling forever from the ceiling like acrobats that will never fall. And so the hope in what they let us hope, that our ideals won't all disappear, that some trace of what we have believed must endure beyond our decay, beyond entropy's law, assuring us we'll live on even after our inevitable dissolve.
Whoa. That's very appropriate for this episode, too.
It is, right?
Wow.
I think so, too. I think it's called polysyndeton, that technique of having like a conjunction begin all this like the and this and that and that or that.
I love that.
Isn't that fucking beautiful?
I really want to know what the piece is.
Oh, yeah. Let me find it and show it to you.
Oh, here it is. Ooh, I thought, yeah, because he's talking about slabs of like concrete, right? I just love that.
It's cool, isn't it?
Wow.
Yeah, it's very, it's like, I guess it's this whole collection. It's very dark. It's dark and sad looking.
Oh, yeah, there my it is. God. Rising, yeah, it's very dystopian. Down. My goodness.
It's like, it looks like almost like pieces of rebar, like chunks of stuff.
Wow. That's
really, really interesting. Yeah, the hunks of pavement heaved and set before us are every road we've tired.
Huh. That's baby. Fucking beautiful.
What you got for us?
Okay. My friend Lyd Havens has a book out called Choke Cherry. I did a blurb for it. And when I read the manuscript, I like shit my pants. And I was like, Lyd, I have to read this right now. And they were like, please wait until it comes out. So I've been dying to read this poem and any of these poems. This poem is called I Only Misgender Myself When Fleetwood Mac Comes On.
All-time title. I think it's the best title of any.
Lyd's titles are awesome.
Hell yeah.
But it's a pretty like heavy book.
Yeah.
And that's coming from me. But, like, I think that's why it resonated with me so much is, like, family trauma and, like,
right,
you know, processing and grief is just,
sure,
you know, it's just cool. Yeah. It's just good to process. And I think it just, anyway, this is that poem. I'm not a woman, but part of me is always going to be a teenage girl, screaming into rivers and watching herself weep in the mirror.
Mm.
Sometimes my hair grows like a curse word. Mm. My lipstick smears and my teeth find a new hysteria to fantasize about. I still identify as a spiteful bitch. The gold dust settles on my cheeks, but I don't. The tables have turned and now my father is afraid of me.
Mm.
Damn my fury, damn my forgiveness. I've learned to fight like an anarchist racehorse. My legs will give out before my heart does. When I was still a girl, I cut all my hair off in mourning twice. When I was still a girl, I found my grandmother's childhood braid framed in an attic. She sliced it off herself while angry at her own father. I sleep with scissors next to my bed just in case. I practice a running start. I tell the mirror what I want to tell my father. You will never get away from the sound of the blank. That hates you.
Wow, that's rad. That's an interesting turn in that too.
Mm-hmm.
I was hoping the Gold Dust Woman was the reference.
Yeah.
That's fucking rad. I also though I have to say that like I'm ruining it. I'm ruining the little bit of resolve that I had. But when I was thinking about mirror father mirror, I made Mary watch Ghost World.
You did not make me. I wanted to watch Ghost World.
You wanted to watch Ghost World. This is one of my absolute favorites. And yeah, there's a great scene where this art teacher, you know, teaching a summer art class, has the class watch this like bizarre black and white art house short film, like with like pieces of dolls and a toilet
and blood, and
while someone is saying mirror, father, mirror. No, but that's a beautiful. That poem is the opposite of Mirror, Father, Mirror. Like, that poem is fucking powerful as fuck. That is what the art teacher wishes.
Yes, exactly.
Okay, I have to rinse this taste out of my mouth.
I know, I can't. This film that I'm feeling.
I feel like I need to take a shower.
I completely agree.
Like, my teeth feel fuzzy.
I feel like I'm never going to wash myself of this.
And I drink 12 gallons of soda a day, and this was too much for me.
This is bad. I'm trying to
another one of those Tic Tacs.
I don't know. I'm trying to think of what is. Did the colliders do it?
I think the collider.
I feel awful.
The slush puppy was. I mean, I had like a 1/15th of a tablespoon of it, and I can't feel my life.
I can't feel my face with slush puppies.
We love y'all. Thank you for being here.
We'll see you next time.
Peace.